Did the Earth once have two moons that collided, stuck together to form the highlands on the lunar far side? This hour, a look at a new idea about the origin of the moon. Can it explain the moon's shape and composition? Then a trip out to Mars, where scientists have spotted strange streaks that appear to come and go with the seasons. Could they be another sign of water? Then sifting through baseball's disabled list for insight into sports injuries. We'll talk with an orthopedic surgeon about what he's found. And the debt ceiling issue is solved for now, but where does that leave spending on energy or the environment? We'll do the numbers after this break. Stay with us. Science is now sexy. Science has become the theme of TV shows and Broadway plays, film and artwork. And we think it's a real trend, and we've created a whole science and arts section right on our website, entertaining interviews with artists and actors, scientists and celebrities. It's the only one of its kind, and I invite you to check it out at sciencefriday.com/arts. This is Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. Unless you've been in a cave for the past week or so, you may just have heard something about Congress and legislation to adjust the nation's debt ceiling. And while the legislation was passed and quickly signed by President Obama to prevent damage to the nation's credit rating, many of the details involved were left for later, cuts to be identified by a super committee at a later date. Joining me now to talk about what all this might mean for environmental and energy issues is Alana Shore. She's a staff reporter at the Energy and Environmental Daily at Green and the Greenwire, and she's been keeping tabs in Congress. Welcome to Science Friday, Alana.
Thanks for having me.
What in the recent debt ceiling bill affects the environment?
Well, the word environment, and for that matter, energy, isn't mentioned, Ira, but what is set are targets for discretionary spending. Now, these are the types of programs, not just energy and environment, but education, housing, basically anything that's not entitlements or the military. And what it promises is huge cuts across the board, below even the levels that we saw back in April when the government nearly shut down and billions were cut.
So we don't really know then what kinds of things might be cut.
Well, I mean, one of the first targets, lawmakers are already saying this, are grants that are given to states and localities to clean up their water supplies. This took a $100 million hit plus in the April deal, and House Republicans are eyeing it already. It's fairly easy, unfortunately, to cut grants that go out the door because, you know, states need them. There's no member of Congress that's going to fight for them.
Going into this battle, there was an emphasis from the Democratic side about ending subsidies for oil and gas production and oil industry tax breaks. Did any of those plans make the final bill?
Unfortunately, not. Because, frankly, the oil industry made a very strong case for keeping its economic benefits, the fact that other industries, you know, receive similar tax deductions. And part of that unfortunate factor there is that ethanol also got its subsidies taken off the table, even though the industry was saying we're ready to get rid of them. Mm-hmm. So there was a real lack of interest in considering revenue of any kind.
Was it were regulations for pollutants affected or attached or onto this bill at the last moment?
They were not. This bill was kept relatively clean of any kind of last-minute, you know, policy prescriptions. But that said, the super committee may well put that back on the table. They have a pretty broad mandate, anything that can be shown to save the government money.
Mm-hmm. So it'll be up to the super committee to decide what might be they might see as the low-hanging fruit, so to speak, that's left in this kind of legislation.
Exactly. And, you know, that could and one has to kind of almost assume it'll include energy and environmental program cuts. Now, and we haven't even gotten to what happens, Ira, if the super committee can't come to an agreement or if what they do suggest is shot down by Congress, because then you have a what's called a sequestration where there's across the board cuts from all these programs, again, of more than $1 trillion over 10 years.
Mm-hmm. Any thoughts that maybe there might be less money for the EPA? I know Congress, their members of Congress are not very happy with the EPA. Might they try to cut some money out of that, for example?
Absolutely. I mean, those grants that I mentioned earlier for safe drinking water and for wastewater treatment go through EPA. And there are plenty of other EPA programs that are already preparing to deal with some really, really lean years. you know, when the president went on television and said these spending levels haven't been seen since the Eisenhower era, you hear a lot of environmentalists, you know, clutching their heart and saying, well, that was before the Clean Air Act, so if we don't have money to enforce that, uh-oh.
Yeah.
It's kind of a sentiment.
Speaking of the Clean Air Act, what about other bills that might be in jeopardy here, or bills that might come up to put environmental legislation or environmental regulations or energy in jeopardy? For example, there are a lot of energy subsidies to help alternative energies out now to help them develop a market. Or might they be in jeopardy?
They very well might be. Democrats are pretty eager to get those oil and gas benefits back in the mix for the super committee. But if that happens, one has to expect that Republicans will say, well, what about the subsidies going to solar and wind?
Right.
And that is almost bound to happen soon, because this committee, Ira, has to make its recommendations by Thanksgiving, which is not too far off in congressional time.
And they're on vacation now.
Right? Yes, they are. Yes.
All right. Ilana, thank you very much for taking time to talk with us.
Thank you.
Good luck to you. Ilana Shore is a staff reporter at the Energy Environment Daily and Greenwire. One theory of how our moon formed suggests that when the Earth was very young, something hit it with an impact so big that it broke off a large chunk that remained close by and became our moon. And looking at the craters on the moon, that should tell you that the lunar surface is no stranger to impacts. But this week comes a new idea. What if, researchers say, the Earth once had two moons? Two. One big, one small. And the smaller one splatted onto the far side of the moon and stuck there. That idea, they say, could explain the highlands on the far side of the moon and perhaps could explain differences in the composition of the lunar surface from one place to another. Joining me now to talk about it is Erik Ostpog, one of the authors of the idea published as a paper in Nature. He's a professor of planetary science at the University of California, Santa Cruz. He joins me from his office there. Welcome back to the program.
Hey, thank you, Ira.
This is a new idea?
Well, it is. It's sort of a stringing together of a couple of ideas into a new one.
Uh-huh. We had a second moon at some time?
Well, you described the hypothesis really well, that you had one moon, the one we know and love, and then you had a smaller moon, about a third the diameter in order to make the model work, and it went unstable. If you go back to the giant impact theory of the origin of the moon, a big planet the size of Mars careens into the Earth, crashes, makes a huge big mess, sets the stage for the rest of our planet's history, pretty much. And from that disk of material pops a moon.
Mm-hmm.
And you see it in models, and you see it in lots of analyses, that you get multiple moons at the start. So that part of it's not entirely new. What's new here is kind of the physics of what happens when this last moon, the last of the small moons, plays out.
Mm-hmm. So the original idea that there was this collision with a large object, that's the same. That's not changing.
That's not changing.
But you're saying that the models show, hey, you know, there shouldn't be just one object, one splat left over, and one piece of debris. There should be a few of them, and that they also agree with that model.
Yeah. And so what's novel here is the end game. As you form the moon pretty quickly, and people haven't spent a lot of time really thinking about the fate of the debris. There have been some papers that sort of study how long these should stick around. But then we started approaching it from the other end of the picture. We had been paying close attention to a lot of models trying to explain the far side of the moon.
Well, what needs to be explained there?
Well, in 1959, the Soviet Luna 3 mission was the first human spacecraft to take any pictures of the backside, and it looked totally different from the near side. If you look up in the sky this evening or in the coming days as the moon waxes, you see the familiar man in the moon or the bunny in the moon, and these are all caused by the huge lava flows that Galileo saw with his telescope, and he called them the maria, the oceans, the seas of the moon. Now, we know that they're volcanic plains, but the moon on the near side has been totally resurfaced. About half of it's been resurfaced by these lavas. And you go back on the backside, and nothing of the sort. It's hills, mountains, and if you measure the gravity of the moon using an orbiter, you find out that the crust on the far side of the moon is about twice as thick as the crust on the near side. And none of the theories that were out there seemed quite adequate to explain that.
So if you smash another object into it, then you can get that extra crust, you can shape the landscape, things like that?
Yeah. You know, modelers, we like to play God. We like to say, you know, here we have a computer code. Let's see what happens if X hits Y. And, you know, you have to obey certain rules of physics. So if you have a colliding object hit the moon, you have to say, well, where did it come from? Now, if you have the moon being clobbered by a cosmic bullet, say somewhere else in the solar system, it's going to hit the moon so fast that just like all the other holes you have in the moon, it's going to form a crater, and it'll actually make a thinning of the crust. It'll actually make a hole, mm-hmm. and we see lots of holes in the moon. And what we wanted for our theory was a collision that was quite slow. Now, slow by cosmic standards is still about 5,000 miles per hour, but we needed something that was so slow that it would have come from the Earth-Moon system itself. And this is where we tried to connect these two theories together, one of a slow cosmic collision that the model shows slaps onto the moon like a pancake and makes this extra crust on the backside, and where this object could have come from in the Earth-Moon system. And so this is where we went back to the old theories that were looking at the stability of these moons. And there are a couple of key spots where a second moon could hide out for about 100 million years and be orbiting along with the moon that we know and love. And these are called the Lagrange points or the Trojan points.
Hmm. Interesting. We have a tweet that came in from Sean who says, have you considered a similar giant impact history from Mars, which also exhibits a high highland-lowland divide?
Well, this is a very good question. We looked at Mars, and a couple of other research groups looked at Mars as a collision, and this is an idea that goes back to the mid-1980s, where Don Wilhelms and Steve Squires looked at you know, how much mass was lost if it was a collision. Now, Mars's northern hemisphere is thinner than the southern hemisphere of Mars in the very same way that the moon is. In this case, it's a, we think, a very high-velocity impact that actually makes a crater. According to this model, the northern plains of Mars, the lowlands, are a big, huge, planet-scaled crater cavity. In the case of the moon, what's curious about that collision is a much slower event doesn't make a crater, and it just splats stuff onto it. It's very much like the physics of a mud clod hitting a wall. Anybody at home can reproduce this moon collision with a couple of snowballs.
Eric, stay with us, okay? We're going to take a break and come back and talk more about this theory about how the moon was formed from two moons, one little one that splatted into the bigger one, and created what we have today. 1-800-989-8255. Tweet us at SciFry. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. Hi, while we're in the break, I'm going to tell you to go over to our video pick of the week. Can you find the octopus? You are not going to want to miss this video. It's up there on our website at sciencefriday.com. Check it out. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking with Eric Ospog, one of the authors of an idea published as a paper in the journal Nature. He's professor of planetary science at the University of California, Santa Cruz, talking about the possibility, the idea that they were not, we once had two moons, a big one and a small one, and a little one smashed splat into the big one on the far side of the moon and created the kind of geology they have over there. Now, is there any way, Eric, to test that theory out?
Well, you know, the easiest way, the most expensive way is always the easiest way, and that's to have another major moon mission that goes and grabs rocks from the far side.
Well, we've been looking for a reason to go back to the moon, haven't we?
Yeah. You know, and I think one of the things about this story, you know, it got a lot of attention, and I wasn't expecting this level of attention, and part of it is just everybody loves the moon. You see it every afternoon. You see it this evening shortly after sunset. It'll be really pretty there up in the sky. And the science questions are quite compelling. One of the things about the moon, if you go and grab a rock from the moon, you bring it back to Earth, chances are it's about 4 billion years old. This is older than almost any of the Earth rocks you're going to find. So one of the reasons why we want to understand the moon and figure out how it got to be and how it's got to have this asymmetry and what kind of a collision environment was going on and what kind of an orbital environment was going on at that time is because that's the hidden record. We're not going to find it here on Earth. It's all been subducted back into the mantle. We don't have any rocks from that epoch. So it's kind of a museum up there that we can go to.
Let's go to the phones. Randy in Elkhart, Indiana. Hi, Randy.
Hi.
Hi there.
I recently heard that Earth has a Trojan satellite also. I wonder when that puppy's going to hit us.
Well, the funny thing is it's actually a pretty safe object because, people have been searching for Earth Trojans for quite a while, and so it was a big news event that we found this, just to explain to the listeners, a Trojan is a satellite that orbits the sun at the same orbit that the Earth orbits the sun. And the Earth's gravity kind of keeps it put about 60 degrees ahead of the Earth. And so this thing's corralled by Earth's and the sun's gravity operating together. So this is actually quite exciting from if you believe in a future that looks like Star Trek, where you're going to be building these big spacecraft out of something, you're going to build them out of asteroids. And so that might be a place where we go and find stuff and maybe are able to build stuff.
Let's go to Lou in Denver. Hi, Lou.
Hello. I have a question about our good old moon, and that is, why do we always see the same face? Is the moon pendulous, so gravity pulls that one face toward us?
You know, if you look at almost all the big satellites in the solar system, they all do the same thing. They have one face facing their planet. And in some cases, like Pluto and its moon, Pluto always has the same face facing its moon. And so they're doubly locked together, kind of like a bolero spinning through space.
So this impact may not have set that up, that synchronicity with the Earth.
This impact probably messed up synchronicity that already existed. This kind of locking in happens pretty quick. It's kind of like an unstable bicycle tire.
Yeah.
You know, it'll always end up with one side on the bottom.
Right.
You got to balance your wheels if that's not going to happen. And so anything that's a little bit unbalanced is going to get locked. This impact probably knocked it a kilter, and then it came back to the way it was. And so it's one of those dynamical things where the big planet likes to lock its moon into place.
Is there any evidence that parts of that moon that originally, you know, those big splat that hit the Earth, that pieces may have fallen back on the Earth?
Well,
created craters or things we haven't discovered because they might be in oceans or something like that.
You know, that certainly happened, that the debris, you know, created a big debris field, and a lot of this re-impacted the Earth. Some of it goes into orbit around the sun, and it's going to hit the Earth a lot later. The Earth's record, though, is so young. The average age of the Earth's surface is only a couple of hundred million years. Oceans are quite young, and the Earth is mostly ocean. We live on this incredibly active planet. And so seeing craters from that long ago, you're not going to see them on Earth, even if they formed.
Andre in Jenison, Michigan. Is it Jenison?
Yeah.
Hi there. Go ahead.
Why don't you think that the moon co-accreted alongside the Earth when they were both forming?
That was the original idea, going back to these really, really smart guys like Laplace and Immanuel Kant, and they thought about... how did this planet formation occur? Well, you have a disk that collapses. It spins out into like a pizza, spins out as a flat thing, and then planets can coalesce, and the moon would coalesce around the Earth. It's a great idea, and the problem is that the moon is so unlike the Earth compositionally. It doesn't have a core, for example, a very small amount of iron at its core. And so why wouldn't it be made of the same stuff as the Earth if it formed along with the Earth? So that's the main argument against co-accretion.
Mm-hmm. Here's a tweet that came in from George Berger. It says, so what kind of orbit would the second moon have had to be in to put it on the far side?
Well, the far side, it could have hit anywhere on the moon. And then this moon, the tidal tugging by the Earth would lock it into place the way we see today. But it does take a special kind of an orbit for this theory to work out. It's a co-orbital with the moon, so it's like this Trojan asteroids. This is a Trojan moon, and it's very stable. for the first couple of 100 million years. But I don't know if everybody knows, the moon's actually receding from the Earth by about 2 inches per year. And early on, it was receding from the Earth much faster even than that. And so what was stable early on became unstable, and that led to the collision that we're theorizing. Was this, it was sort of anchored in this one spot, and then eventually it got loose and got into trouble.
How close was the closest point? You say it was receding, our moon. How close was it at one point?
Well, if you go and look at the first thinking about how the moon formed that addressed this idea of, we knew that the density of the moon was much less than the density of Earth back in the 1860s. And so we already knew that the moon had to form in some magical manner that we hadn't understood. And so George Darwin, the son of Charles Darwin, he was a geophysicist who knew that the moon was receding from the Earth. The evidence is in fossils. You can see that the Earth's day used to be faster. The month used to be longer. You see this recorded in clamshells and corals that record the day and record the month. And so he pieced together the fact that the moon's coming towards the Earth, is leaving the Earth. And if you go backwards in time, he calculated how long it would have been when the moon was part of the Earth. And so he came up with what is known as the fission hypothesis. And he proposed that the moon popped out of the Pacific Ocean when the Earth was rapidly rotating. And so you can do that kind of argument. And that's what makes moon theory so fun, is you have a couple of pretty live hypotheses out there, and all of them have pretty significant implications for how it all started.
If the moon was so close, would it have affected the Earth's surface? Maybe the water? Was there water at that time? Or would the seas been, we have tides now. Would they have been incredible at that period?
Yeah, the tides go with the square of the distance. And so as you get closer and closer in, the tides get amplified quite a bit. When you talk about this early epoch, when the moon was really close, probably Earth had oceans as of maybe 4.4, 4.3 billion years ago. We have maybe some evidence of the first oceans on the surface of the Earth. If you go farther back in time, around the time the moon had just formed, and you think about the planet, well, Earth was, probably this hot lava ball with a steam atmosphere and a lot of hydrogen in its atmosphere, and it was really a messy, nasty place. So the tides that would be raised would be powerful and significant, but it wasn't really until about maybe 4.1 billion years ago when the solar system's activities had started tapering down a lot and things had settled down that somehow, and this is the big mystery, we started the process of the first life on Earth.
Interesting. Fascinating. Well, I think we'll just have to go back to the moon.
I agree.
And get some samples from the far side.
You can send me if you want.
Okay. I'm putting you at the top of the list. When they come and ask me, I'll put you right up there.
All right.
Thank you, Eric. Fascinating.
Thanks, Eric.
Fascinating idea that we once had two moons, one little piece broke off and hit into the backside of the moon and smushed together like clay and stuff. It's very interesting. Thanks a lot, Eric.
Thanks.
Eric Ospog is professor of planetary science at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and one of the authors of an article in the journal Nature suggesting that, the Earth once had two moons. Moving out a bit further into our planetary neighborhood, next stop, Mars. We've known for a while that there's ice on Mars, but now researchers say that they may have seen signs of liquid water in the form of dark streaks that appear and disappear with the seasons on certain Martian slopes. And the work is described in the journal Nature. You can see some photos of it up on our website at sciencefriday.com. Nature, I meant science. In the journal Science, and joining me now to talk about it is Alfred McEwen. He's the lead author on that paper in Science and the principal investigator on the high-rise camera. That's part of the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. He's also a professor in Lunar and Planetary Laboratory at the University of Arizona in Tucson. Welcome back, Dr. McEwen.
Hello, Ira. How are you?
It sure does look like there's water trickling down the slopes here.
It looks like something flowing down the slopes, yes.
Something. You're being very science correct on this.
I'm going to be very descriptive about this, and we're calling these recurring slope lineae, a terribly boring name for these, intentionally to be purely descriptive, so we don't bias ourselves into thinking we know exactly what they are as we investigate further.
But surely you wouldn't have published the paper if you didn't think it might have been water.
Not in science, but we found these features. Well, we've been searching for current activity on Mars for some time and finding all sorts of interesting things. Sand is moving around, new impact craters, and in the region that receives CO2 frost in the wintertime, there's a whole suite of dynamic processes that occur, including the gullies that are active. There's been a lot of discussion about that being due to water, and it was a surprise to find that they're active today in the winter when there's CO2 frost in the ground and the temperatures are way too cold for water. And I was beginning to think, okay, that's where all the action is. It's in the winter when there's CO2 frost. But then we found these features, which are just the opposite in season. They're active in the summertime when it's warmest.
Can it actually get warm enough to have liquid water there?
The surface temperatures can get up to a balmy 80 degrees Fahrenheit or so, maybe even warmer, although it is still much colder at night, and it's colder also just down an inch in depth because it's so cold at night. You're down deep enough, you get the average temperature.
Mm-hmm. So these streaks that you see, because they're seasonal and they happen in the summer, may mean they might be water.
They have a suite of characteristics. They're found only in the middle latitudes, which are places where we have other evidence for the presence of ground ice. It's a little bit equatorward of that, but there could be ice a bit deeper than we've seen previously. But only on the equator-facing slopes. So it's high enough in latitude for there to be ice in the ground, but still places that get warm enough to get above the melting point of water, or at least salty water.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about the possibility of finding water on Mars this hour on Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow talking with Alfred McEwen. So is there any way, of course, we're not going, we're not on Mars. We can't take samples back. Any way that you can strengthen this case for it being water?
Yeah, great question. So far we don't have direct evidence for water. There is the Compact Reconnaissance Imaging Spectrometer for Mars, CRISM, that's observed some of these sites and continuing to observe. Now, they have an 18-meter per pixel footprint, and we think that there's wetness only in small areas for very short periods of time. It really dries out in a hurry on Mars. They don't see water. That's not surprising, although it would be nice to have some sort of direct confirmation. They're going to keep looking, but the other thing we can do, I think, is most promising, is laboratory experiments. These are small-scale features, so simulating this in the lab. There are a dozen labs around the country and in Europe and elsewhere where they can pump down the pressure to simulate a Martian atmosphere, adjust the temperature. It ought to be possible to reproduce some of the key behaviors we're seeing in the laboratory and really give us a strong answer on whether or not water is required.
Is there any other place on Mars where you see possible evidence of running water like this?
No, not of running water. Now, at the Phoenix landing site, they saw these droplets form on the lander legs, which could have been salts. Salts can absorb water from the atmosphere. It's called deliquescence. That's one idea for where the water comes from these slope streaks that we're seeing. But also they discovered perchlorate. That's a particular salt that in solution could have a very low freezing point, such that during the Arctic summer there may be pods of water that form out of little salt patches, but it isn't flowing as far as we know. Mm-hmm. And it's very cold water. This would be warmer water.
Mm-hmm. And this would be salty water too then?
Probably salty, yeah. That's just because a couple of reasons. First, Mars is a very salty place. Every lander and rover, Martian meteorites, remote sensing shows salts on Mars. So any water that flows on the surface, shallow subsurface, should become salty, even if it doesn't start off that way. But secondly, some of this activity occurs when the surface temperatures are too cold for pure water to melt.
Mm-hmm.
Or to remain in a liquid state. And also, pure water at these sites would actually boil, even when it's near the freezing point of water. The atmospheric pressure is so low, it boils and is highly unstable. Salty water is a little more stable.
Given the fact that you've seen these streaks on the slopes, could there be others that you'd be looking for?
We're looking. We've seen these this particular activity in seven places where we've confirmed repeat in multiple years, and another 12 or 20 or so that are likely or candidate sites. And we're going to keep looking for more of these. And that's a key characteristic, by the way, the fact that these recur year after year. It doesn't just happen and it's done. Following year, new ones form. That they may be
right.
Slightly different place, but they clearly recur. And so we're going to keep looking for more of this particular type of activity. But what surprises me is the fact that it took us so long to discover this at all. It was actually hiding in our data from several years ago. So I wonder how many more things there are that are still waiting to be discovered.
Mm. Well, we'll talk. Can you stay with us a few more minutes? We're going to take a break. We'll come back and talk more with Alfred McEwen, principal investigator on the high-rise camera. That's part of this satellite that's going around Mars, the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, snapping these pictures, sending back so much data, so many photos. It takes years to sift through them and see these photos. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Go to our website at sciencefriday.com. You can see the pictures of the streaks of coming down the side of the slopes of these hills. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. You hear me on the air every week, but do you know what it's like inside our studios? Yeah, you can check out pictures from the studio every Friday at our Facebook page, facebook.com/scifry. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the possibility of liquid water on Mars, some intriguing satellite images, and then the satellite is the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, sending stuff, photos back to investigators who are manning the high-rise camera. My guest is Alfred McEwen, who is principal investigator on the high-rise camera. Dr. McEwen, I guess this shows you that you got to just keep the camera in one spot for a long enough time to see changes, right?
Well, we have this interesting conflict between whether to image new sites or whether to re-image old sites to look for changes. So we just do a little bit of both.
Mm-hmm. And you got? Would you say you got lucky here, or you don't want to use that word?
Maybe. We actually saw many of these by targeting mid-latitude craters because the gullies are there and they're of interest. And we were looking for gully activity and weren't really looking for this small-scale type activity and in the summer season and so forth. So we got lucky in eventually finding it, although I feel like we should have found it sooner.
Well, you had the prepared mind, right, as they talk about?
No. If I had been smart, I would have thought, where's the most likely place to find actual water on Mars today? And would have targeted these places for exactly that purpose. But no, we had to wait for an undergraduate student here to find it for us instead.
There you go. Nothing more needs to be said. Let's go to the phones. Matt in St. Louis. Hi, Matt. Matt, are you there?
Good afternoon.
Hi there.
Yes. My question is, where are Spirit and Opportunity? Would it be feasible or even possible to send them for samples?
All right, good question, Matt. The Mars rovers, one is pretty stuck and not going anywhere, right?
Yep. Yeah, Spirit is not going anywhere. Its mission has been declared over 100% successful. Opportunity is headed towards Endeavour Crater, but it's right near the equator. We just don't see any of this activity near the equator, and we don't see it particularly in Endeavour Crater. And it moves really slowly on a global scale compared to MRO circling the planet 13 times a day. So there's really not much hope of opportunity getting to one of these sites. There's another rover, MSL, a Flanagan and Gale crater. That, again, is near the equator. And, again, we don't see evidence of this activity. And also, if this is water, then you have to design the rover with certain planetary protection standards that weren't done for these rovers. So we really need a new mission.
You mean you don't want to contaminate the planet?
We don't want to contaminate any water with earth bugs,
right,
and then discover earth bugs.
Yeah, so you'd have to have a whole new mission that's sterile when it got there.
Yes, and but the Phoenix lander, for example, had an arm that dug into ice, and that arm was sterilized, not the rest of it.
Well, this is a new excuse to set up another mission, don't you think?
Yes, they're getting harder to get, though.
Yeah, well, we know about the monetary problems and big ideas not getting funded anymore. So thank you, and good luck to you, Dr. McEwen.
Okay, thank you.
Alfred McEwen, a principal investigator on the high-rise camera, part of the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. He's also a professor in the Lunar and Planetary Laboratory at the University of Arizona in Tucson. Here we are in the midst of the baseball season, my favorite season, and no matter what team you root for, you know that injuries can make or break a team's season. So it might surprise you to know that in Major League Baseball, there's no central record of who got injured doing what. Other sports organizations have such registries, but not baseball. And that's surprising considering that, you know, it seems that baseball gurus keep statistics for just about everything imaginable. Well, that's about to change. A team of baseball-minded doctors has mined the disabled list of teams for recent years and has put together its own set of data on Major League Baseball injuries. Joining me now to talk about what they have found is one of those doctors, Brett Owens. He's chief of orthopedic surgery at Keller Army Hospital in West Point, New York. Welcome to the program, Dr. Owens.
Thank you very much. It's an honor to be here.
This is not an Army West Point project, is it?
This is not, and yeah, that's a good point.
So you're doing this as sort of a hobby?
Pretty much as a hobby, and you know, clearly, just to start off, you know, my employer wants to make it clear that you know I am an active duty Army orthopedic surgeon, and you know, these are my personal opinions and don't reflect any official positions.
Well, maybe they'll be jealous of them later on.
I'm not sure.
You get to be famous about these statistics, and they're going to say, oh, yeah, he was an Army doctor. So tell us about this. You've been keeping track of you had to dig into the records to find out the injuries.
Well, yeah, exactly. Like you put, there is no officially sanctioned injury surveillance system in Major League Baseball. As you'd mentioned, you know, other sports, you know, primarily the NCAA has been very successful with being able to monitor its injuries. But Major League Baseball doesn't have a dedicated injury surveillance system, even though there has been some discussion recently about that.
1-800-989-8255 is a number talking about the Major League Baseball injuries. Did you find that injuries, there's a trend in injuries. Are they rising, falling? What can you tell us?
You know, clearly we studied one small subset, you know, in time, basically seasons 2002 through 2008. And, you know, in that small seven season sample, there appeared to be an increase, you know, over time. We broke it into two sets up to 05, and those are on a 30%, 7% increase, you know, over time. There's been one other prior study, Stan Conti and all, that did look at over 11-year period, and they found that the number of injuries also increased, you know, over time.
Mm-hmm. And was there a bigger increase? I'm looking at a story from the news wires here that from Reuters that it quotes your study and says that player injury rates jumped by nearly 40% after 2005. Is that correct?
Correct. It was increased 37% between, you know, 05 and 08.
Well, that was at the time when the drug policy changed.
Correct.
Is there any connection?
Well, clearly that's one potential, you know, possibility. But, you know, clearly that's speculative based upon our data. We're not really able to say right now. Yeah. We were able to look at one small subset in time. And, you know, clearly that's one of the things that we did look at was whether it did influence, you know, injury rates. And there appears, you know, to be a pattern, but it's really hard to say unless you look specifically at the injuries.
Can you tell us, give us an idea who gets injured most and what kinds of injuries there are?
Yeah, certainly upper extremity injuries seem to dominate the entire spectrum of baseball players, you know, accounting for around 51% of all injuries were upper extremity, mainly shoulder, elbow. You know, but when we break it down between pitchers and position players, there's a stark difference with, again, the not surprising, the pitchers have majority shoulder and elbow injuries. The fielders were predominantly, you know, lower extremity. They had a lot of knee, hamstring injuries. Also had a little bit a higher rate of hand and wrist injuries.
Mm-hmm. And did they happen? I noticed from reading your paper they happened mostly at the beginning of the season, right, or at spring training.
Well, we didn't. We specifically excluded spring training because it's really hard to determine. Again, our data really focuses on the disabled list classification, so that excludes all the little minor bumps and sprains that may well go unnoticed. Patient player may be placed, you know, day to day, may not play a couple of days, but is not going to result in a designated list designation by disabled list designation by the team. That's an injury that results in them being out of play for at least 15 days. They can also go on the 60-day DL, as all of us know that are baseball fans. But clearly, the limitations of our study is that we look just at the disabled list injuries.
And as I say, they happened, if I read your...
Correct.
They happened like in April, a lot of them were.
Correct. We had a higher instance injury rate in April, especially compared to September. But some of the caveats of our study is that we were limited by this disabled list clarification by the team.
But it's also...
a lot of players in September might not be placed on the disabled list as the team expands to a 40-player roster, and there may not be as much pressure to place the player on the disabled list. But we had a higher injury rate in April compared to the later in the season.
So that means, as you're saying, the disabled list is not a good barometer of injuries because they may not be on there. Teams may not want to place them on there.
Correct. It is not the optimal barometer of injuries. It is a crude barometer of injuries, and it's the best we have right now.
Should Major League Baseball take this more, I'm going to use the word seriously, in keeping good statistics about this?
Well, I have no official relationship with Major League Baseball. I'm just a fan. I would think that they are interested in this. There has been some work in this area in the past. I'm not sure exactly what the hurdles are to create this. As you understand, you know, teams, I'm sure, want to be somewhat protective of this data.
Yeah, but they, you know, they should let the public know. In the other sports, we know that there's a lot of gambling involved in lots of sports. Could it be that, you know, there's not as much gambling involved in baseball so that there's not as much concern about who's injured?
I'm not sure. It's a very interesting point.
You know, what kind of injuries you say pitchers were the number one injured players?
Correct. They had around a 67%, you know, upper extremity injury rate, but compared to fielders, they had a 2 to 3 times injury rate for the upper extremity injuries.
Wow. And is that because they have such, you know, violent motions with their bodies when they're doing something?
Well, certainly, you know, that would make sense. The pitching motion is one of the more extreme acts that a shoulder or an elbow can experience, and to repeat that, you know, numerous occasions, you can get these repetitive, overuse type injuries. Mm-hmm. You know, clearly it's been documented the increase in you know, Tommy John or ulnaclavicular ligament reconstructions. So it's not really surprising that the pitchers had more shoulder and elbow injuries.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any opinions on what's going on with injuries with kids and who play Little League or in schools about the kind of injuries they're getting?
Sure. There's been, you know, a great deal of interest in this recently. My parent organization, American Orthopedic Society for Sports Medicine, has been very involved. And actually, I would refer folks who want to learn a little bit more about this to the website, which is stopsportsinjuries.org. But there clearly has been a large push into trying to stop some of these injuries that happen to young athletes, particularly junior pitchers seem to experience a great deal of overuse type injuries that hadn't been experienced in previous generations.
We're talking with Brett Owens about baseball injuries this hour on Science Friday from NPR. Would a centralized listing of injuries be useful to people? If you were able to collect them, what kind of good use could you make out of that?
Well, I think looking at injuries from a larger viewpoint, not looking at from a specific single provider perspective or from the perspective of a large hospital system or someone that takes care of one team, you're able to, when you pool all the data together, you're able to better see injury patterns that haven't been appreciated before. This, you know, the most notable example in orthopedic surgery is some researchers that looked at ACL injury patterns between men and women. And they use collegiate basketball, but the NCAA has an established database. These researchers in 95 were able to compare women versus men in the same sport, and they found, you know, I believe it was 8 times injury rate in women versus men when they control for athletic exposure. You know, clearly more men are playing sports most of the time, but when controlling for athletic exposure, meaning one practice per person, one game per person, the women had a higher injury rate, and that's caused us to take a step back and look at landing patterns for women, other differences physiologically that may help account for this difference in injuries rates, and then hopefully work towards prevention patterns.
And because Major League Baseball does not have an established database, you could not do that in that sport.
Correct. And clearly you had made some comment earlier about possibly making it public. The disabled list is kind of the public disclosure of that injury. I'm not sure if a publicly accessible database is the best, but at least internally to be able to track injuries may have some significant benefit for players.
1-800-989-8255. Let's see if we can get a quick call in here from Ken in St. Louis. Hi, Ken.
Hi, Ira. Love your show.
Thank you.
Mr. Owen, I want to tell you about 1968, Bob Gibson world record ERA. His catcher was Tim McCarver. In 69, the owners took 8 inches off the pitching mound and took the legs out of the pitching. That's the reason for all these injuries.
I've spoken like a true St. Louis Cardinals fan.
If you don't ask me, I'll tell you, contact Tim McCarver. He talks about this all the time.
Well, we all know that Bob Gibson was a terrific, a great pitcher. And the man, being a baseball fan, I know exactly what you're talking about. Lowering the mound took the advantage away the pitchers were enjoying. Do you think, Brett, that might have contributed to injuries pitchers are getting now?
Clearly there's discussion, of that. I agree. Tim McCarver does go on about that, and I have to listen to him covering the games as well. And I agree. Clearly that may have something to do with it. I wish we had data going back to that time frame.
Doesn't it surprise you with all the stats? And as a baseball fan, how it is a stat for everything, and there are new metrics coming out all the time. Right? Wisps and things you never heard of when we were kids. Is it surprising that they don't collect these statistics?
It is surprising a little bit, but the numbers that are collected now in baseball, as well as other sports, looking at fantasy football, for example, they've been able to use some of these numbers almost as proxies for outcome, so to say. There's a recent study that looked at ACL injuries in NFL players, and they used their power number, which is a fantasy football score, as a sort of as an outcome score to evaluate how well they did after ACL reconstruction. So the numbers can help quantify sometimes the disability and/or the success maybe after an intervention.
Well, here's hoping we get some sort of central database for you guys to use as research tools.
That would be great.
All right. Thank you, Brett.
Hey, thank you.
Dr. Brett Owens is chief of orthopedic surgery at the Keller Army Hospital in West Point, New York. Some of you have asked us, why is it necessary to include ads in these podcasts? It's a good question. The simple answer is we have to find some way to pay for them. NPR does not underwrite our podcasts or any of our social media, like our website or our videos. In fact, they only contribute 10% of our total budget. So instead of charging you for this podcast, we put in a couple of ads. If you'd like to help close that deficit, please go to our website at sciencefriday.com and click on the support button and donate a few bucks. Thanks.